in his very personality. And the schism, the split, is not due to men's revolt against his nature, as Christian theology has thought since the days of Augustine, according to which, according to Christian thought, that man has perfectly set himself in opposition to being the image of God. And he succeeded in producing another image, the image of empiricalness. The schism in consonance with the Judaic view is not a result of sin or rebellion, but was willed by God. And this schism is responsible for man's greatness and his election, the election of man as a singular charismatic being. Man is a great and creative being. You know why? Because he is formed by something. Because he's always in a state of ontological, I don't say psychological, ontological tension and perplexity. And that's why the creative gesture in any area, science, music, philosophy, the creative gesture is associated with agony, because the source of creativity is not harmony of man, but contradiction in him. So let me ask, Judaic dialectic, unlike the Hegelian dialectic, is an irreconcilable and hence interminable dialectic, consisting only of thesis and antithesis. There is no synthesis in Judaism. The third Hegelian stage, namely that of reconciliation, is missing, unfortunately, in Jewish thought. We Jews think that only God knows how to reconcile. We think complete reconciliation of opposite is to us an eschatological vision. To Hegel, we have studied Hegel, and men and history, men and his history, were just abstract ideas. And it is always easy to find sympathy in a world of abstraction. To Judaism, man has always been not an idea, but a living reality. And may I perhaps say, a tragic reality. And the world of reality, reconciliation of opposites, is almost a new possibility. The Jew knows the thesis, affirmation. The Jew knows negation, antithesis. He doesn't know of reconciliation. And let me introduce you a word from the Psalms. The Psalms proclaim, Neo Marti Vechazi, Kala Adam Kodesh. I said in haste, all men are liars. The simple question, right? What kind of a lie did the Psalms have in his mind when he hurled such a serious accusation charge that men at large, all of us, everybody's alive. drama that dominates the everyday social life. My neighbor invites me to supper. I don't want to socialize or fraternize with him. But instead of telling him the truth, I'll use an excuse. I've already accepted the invitation from a friend. And you, unfortunately, the question has not accepted the invitation. Does it refer to the commercial life? To the dishonest business? Or to the political life? I don't have to give you an example of it. Or to the judicial line in court, perjury? Does it refer to breach of promise? To promises not kept? To untrue statements? In a word, does it speak of the lie which I tell the Tao, which I tell others? Is it an indictment of mankind, as such? What right is there to indict mankind, as such? Does man indeed lie continually to his friends and associates? By no means. The psalmist is concerned with a different life. May I say that the psalmist speaks not of an immoral life, he speaks of a moral life. Of course, you look at me, it's a contradictio in adjecto or objecto. How is it possible for a life to be moral? The moral life is the one which man tells not others, but to his insight. Man indeed is a liar, because he is involved in an interminable controversy, contradiction, in an insoluble dialectic, because he is pleased right in the middle, because he is caught like the biblical ram of Abraham in a thicket of antinomy and they cut. And he swings like a pendulum between two poles, between the thesis and antithesis, between affirmation and negation, identifying himself with both of them or with none. This metaphysical eye is the spring well of human creativity. The agony accompanying the practice of creativity is due to the fact that I said before that man formed by conflict, not harmonious man. It is obvious that dialectical man can be committed, cannot be committed, and in uniform, homogeneous morality in such a zone. If man is dialectical, so is his moral gesture. Moral gesture is also dialectical. And the halacha, you know what halacha is? Jewish law. But for me, it's a substitute for the term Judaism. Or let us say Judaism, I don't care. Generally, it's more popular with you, use it. Judaism has indeed formulated such a dialectical morality. There are two objectives. Moral men tell you. And both objectives are mutually exclusive. As a matter of fact, the title of the lecture is Two Sources of Judaism for All. It's not correct. It's my fault. Don't blame anybody else for that. technically being two objectives today for our I use this concept, instead of objective, in order to paraphrase the famous book by Henri Bergson, Two Sources of Morality. I just said it today. I believe that the basic dialectic of man and his morality was beautifully portrayed in the Midrashic Homily quoted by Rashi in Genesis. This homily is a comment to the verse. Vayiter Hashem Elokim et Adam Ofor min Adamo. And God created man from the dust of the earth. So Rashi in the name of the Midrash quotes two interpretations. Interpretation number one. Tovah Rafoi Mikol Adamo Me'arba Ruchim. God gathered the dust from which man was formed, from the entire earth, from all four corners. Interpretation number two is not all our foreign invoking Shemema Mizbach Adom Otapri. He took the dust from which man was made, from the path which was designated by the Almighty at the very dawn of creation as the future site of the old path. As it is written in Exodus, an altar of earth thou shalt make unto me. Let us take up the first interpretation. Man was created of the dust gathered from all four corners of the earth. For man was created of cosmic dust. God gathered the dust from which men were fashioned from all parts of the earth, indeed, from all charted and uncharted lands of the cosmos. What does it mean? What did our sages intend to convey? What message did they want to put across? Man belongs everywhere. He is not a stranger in any part of the universe. He is a native son of the village, of the sleepy little town beyond the bend of the river, where he was born and raised, and at the same time, a son and a citizen, a part distant, a part unknown. In short, man is a cosmic being. He is cosmic in a threefold manner. Number one, through his intellectual involvement in the past. His intellectual curiosity is, as always been, still is, a cosmic universal dimension. He wants to know not only about things close to him, like the flowering bush in his backyard, but also about things far removed from him, things remote, things and events millions of light years away, but many curious to know about it. Human cosmic inquisitiveness border almost on the elegant. Man is restless because he has not yet solved the mysterious magnum of creation. And if you near you out the house, confining you, you'll have a problem. Remoteness, instead of diminishing, magnifies immense curiosity. The latter, the curiosity of man, is proportionate to the distance, separating man from the object of misery. The farther the object, the greater and more ecstatic is the curiosity. Man is the son of the universe, since he is intellectually involved in the universe. Man wants to own the universe. I mean, in juridic terms. The universe should belong to him. Let me ask you a question. Who owns the universe? Who? Of course, the answer is, L'Adishem or Ashimeo. The universe belongs to God. He is the real owner. But God granted man partial ownership. To whom be the grand partial ownership? To me, I can tell you no. All I have is a howling group in the morning. To you, I doubt. But I know a man who owned it, who did own the universe, according to the universe, the planet, he did own it. Who is it? I would say it was Kepler. Why did he own the planet? Because he understood. Who owns the universe? Who is inquisitive and curious about it? Who owns the universe? Who is inquisitive? Who wants to find out everything about the universe? Who owns the universe? The man who has the star as his fingertip, as he used to say, a scanner. The man wants to have the star as his fingertip. However, man's involvement in the universe is not only of intellectual nature, it is also of an experiential nature. Man is consciousness oriented, not only intellectually, but emotionally as well. He not only wants to be curious about the universe, he loves it. He loves the consciousness, the boundless. The limit, the end of the universe. He wants to be everywhere. In fact, he is questing not only to know the universe, but to experience it. He is an explorer, an adventurer. He would like to visit the outskirts. Apparently bored by the monotony and routine of familiar surroundings, he is out to see the world. Man is not satisfied with sending out unmanned vehicles in order to gather scientific data for him. On the moon, and the Mars, and the inner. Many of us to send out people. Who are the light of the earth? It's not a scientific effort. That makes man send out actually astronauts on the moon of the or in the future, the Mars of the universe. No. Because man's desire of cosmic life. He wants to live in it. Nothing. To move with the velocity of life into the world of the unknown. Man wants to experience and enjoy the cosmos, the vastness. This quest is not only an intellectual one, it's an aesthetic. He loves the cosmos. Suffering because of that. And carefully. Man, in general, is a moving being, very moving. Man has a tremendous capacity for moving. He can easily detach himself from native surroundings and adapt himself to a new environment. His mobility transcends by far that of animals. Man, I have no doubt, in the distant future, will have colonies and settlements at some point. And perhaps the main time, even manage to fly to new solar systems. And the birth in Deuteronomy, Kiodom is Hasore, Lovely Panechoba Mother, is a rhetorical question. Man, is man like the tree of the field? He is certainly not. Is the tree as mobile as man is? Certainly not. Man's greatness and distinctiveness expresses themselves in his ceaseless mobility. The tree is inseparable from the soil. Man can and does move away from home. But I want to add something. The term cosmic man is not to be taken literally as referring exclusively to those who penetrate the interplanetary space or to those who are committed to this objective. The term cosmic man has a much wider scope and it characterizes man as a quester and searcher for vastness and boundlessness. In any area, in any human endeavor, be it science, be it commerce, be it industry, be it the political community, or even aid. In short, man is a cosmic being when he is mesmerized by the infinite number of opportunities his fantasy presents to him and forgets the simple tragic fact that he is finite and mortal. And to reach out for infinity, and for a mortal being to reach out for infinity, is at best a foolhardy end. This is one view of the Midrash. There is another view of the Midrash. Man was created from the dust of a single spark. In other words, man is not cosmic at all. The light. It is just a pigment of human fantasy. He is committed to one motive. The Creator assigned him to a single status. He calls, or we call, home. Man is not cosmic. He is here minded. He is a rooted being, not a cosmopolitan. He is a provincial, a villager, who belongs to the soil that fed him while he was a child, and while the green wood and the narrow, sleepy river, and the water flows lazily. At this juncture, I'm not speaking psychological doubts, I'm speaking about the metaphysical ethics of man. At this juncture, we come across an old biblical idea, which is very mysterious to us, but plays a great role in the Bible. Namely, the idea of nachala, inheritance, or hope. We remind ourselves of the solemn words spoken with trepidation by another, King Ahab, when the latter suggested to him that Naboth exchange the vineyard he inherited from his ancestors for another, more beautiful vineyard. And what did Naboth say? The Lord forbid. that I should keep the inheritance of my father unto thee. Man, from a biblical viewpoint, is rooted in his nachla, in his inheritance, in his home. When torn away, when he's torn away, he becomes, what the Bible calls, navana, a restless vagabond. Dislocated not only physically, but spiritually as well. Homelessness is a curse. The word galut in our history was the most horrible curse. What is galut? Homeless, exiled. Because man is questing for nachala. Oh, I would say you, for the Arachi, which he thinks you can find in Nahala. He is curious to know everything, not only about himself, but about his roots. About what we call in Hebrew, Makor, and the Germans have a beautiful word for it, Ursprung. The Greek Archei, he wants to find himself. The man cannot find himself on the outskirts of the castle, among the flying reptiles, born in the pure pubes of his home there. He can find the link between him and some mysterious origin. Yes, he may roam through the dark spaces and lanes of the universe, he may climb to the stars, yet the traveler, the adventurer, out to conquer infinity, will finally return home. Is this homecoming, there's always a homecoming for me, is this homecoming does not occur during his lifetime, because man is too busy, too preoccupied with motion and exploration. It will happen posthumously, when his body will be brought home in the quiet, long graveyard behind the grove in heaven. What did death mean to the biblical tradition? To men of the time. What did it mean to God? Know that death meant to the men, to the biblical man, to return. What kind of return? Return to whom? Return to what? Answer is return to the answer, to the thought. עצוב חויה לאדומו, אשר ממנו לוקחת, כי עפר אתה, על עפר תשכח. כאילו דאו ריטרן אנטודי גרם, פר אאוט אני, ואת דאו תיקן, פר דאו ארט דאו, אנטו דאט דאו שלטת. The Bible identifies dying is return to the ancestors. The actors of the Yishalom ala Tatecha. You will come, you will return, you see, to thy ancestors. Did not Jacob request of Joseph, carry me out of Egypt, and bury me in there, in his ancestors' burying place? No, men wanted to return home. That's how beautiful is the Midrash said, the dust out of which men of fashion was not taken from all parts of the universe, but from a single spot on a mountain, when an altar was many, many years later constructed. Each man is created from dust at one place, and it touched a single spot to the algae on which he cannot feed. This yearning of all, the quest of the algae, pulls men like a powerful magnet. Why did you come back to me? To listen to me. An old, long-winded rabbi. I felt that you are searching. For what are you searching? What? What are you missing? What are you searching? What are you questing for? That is the best house which you are for and ask. Was not gathered from all parts. And I don't care what name you apply to them. It is the fact. You want to find out something about yourself by identifying yourself with the source and the action, with the Ursprung. And I always appreciate the simple line in Robert Stevenson, home from sea, home is a sailor home from sea, and the hunter home from the sea. These beautiful lines contain more than nostalgic memories. They contain an eternal death. When I happen to visit from time to time with a matter of fact, I witnessed a similar scene this morning when I happened to visit the alarm of TWA air terminals, and unintentionally, by sheer coincidence, I sometimes watch the shipping of double coffins containing the body of dead body of the Jew. You live, work, raise children, prosper, or fail in the United States, sheep for burial, in the land of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, I first born. So not the Jewish one here. When I see that, I really knew it. Think of the great mystery of acting. We still get the spell upon the alienated American Jews. Many modern, secular, alienated Jews who want to rest in eternal peace close to their origin. In the proximity of the title, who were the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's a strange phenomenon. And tell me, friend, what is the Zionist commission in itself? Is it a logical commission? Can you rationalize it? Can you understand it in terms of political planning? In terms of economy, in terms of historical pragmatism, is it understandable? Why form a little island at the stormy sea, surrounded by 100 million enemies? Oh, why? I have no answer. I welcome in the leadership of the state of the headmaster. The answer is the man who was fashioned out of the dust between himself. And of course it's very hard to say that. Be it in a geographic sense, be it in a spiritual sense. And that's why we hope, we have faith, that finally all Jews will embrace slavery, because every Jew is longing to quest for his passion. I'm not a political director. No, I'm engaged. No, I'm not engaged in propaganda for you. All I do is to understand phenomena. And origin conscious man quest for God. Even though they are not always aware of that. Man in his feverish haste to get farther and farther away from home, as well as in his lonesomeness for home and in his experiences, the spell that home casts upon him. Both yearn for God. How does Catholic man find God? How does Catholic man find God? If he is interested in finding it, many are not interested. How does he find it? Where? Where does Catholic man find God? In the heavenly galaxy, millions of billions at light years away. Where does homebound, origin-minded man find God? Not in the galaxy. Not in the vastness and the endlessness of the universe. But in limitedness and in the narrowness of finite. In the smallness of the mother's soul into which he was born, into which he really knew himself. He discovered God in the origin, in the soul, in the center of the burning bush, where did Moses discover God? Moses also escaped from home, escaped from his brother. He escaped from reality. He became a legion. He was standing the flag of his power. But some mysterious power pulled him back. Then he discovered what was. Either infinity cannot contain God. God is above and beyond. He's the center of the best bush. It's not the bush. As a rule, and I'm a bit embarrassed, but I have to draw my own experience. God. Because all for me. What have I done about it? O Lord, my God, thou art very great. Thou art clothed with glory and majesty. This is that moment. This is ready to pray. However, it is the arrival for the mystics, the medieval mystics used to call, with the arrival of the dark night and the lonely soul. In moments of agony and black despair, the living becomes less than human, becomes ugly and absurd. To use a term of philosophical I don't like, starter, the living becomes nauseating. I don't like it. But the Karen is a group. So praise the Lord. The man loses his sense of beauty and majesty. But man, he is God. God addresses himself not to man, not from him to the beast. Because the man is enveloped by the darkness of the night of his soul, he has no sense for majesty and infinity. He addresses to him from the infinitesimal. God rests either in infinity or in the infinitesimal. Those are mathematical concepts. And God rests either in empty then God addresses to him from some single spot in the darkness which surrounds suffering man. He addresses himself to man from the black despair itself. I remember, and please forgive me if I introduce you a personal experience. But I cannot draw on your experience. 6 years ago, I was living 10 weeks, my mother, my brother, and my beloved wife. When my wife was on her deathbed, and I watched her dying day by day, hour by hour, it was wonderful. I could not pray in the hospital. I could. Somehow I was so blind, I could not thank God in the whitewashed long corridor among the Indians and Russians, not that they have anything against the Indians. But the world too technical, you might say. And so I was not even in the place. It was black despair, which completely overwhelmed me, but I couldn't pray. However, every time I used to come home in late evening, I used to rush into my room, small room, fall on my knees, and pray fervently. God, in those moments, was not the exalted majestic king. I saw God as the exalted majestic king. During that night, he was not a majestic king, far from me, abiding in infinity, beyond the outskirts of the castle. But he was a humble, close friend, brother. He was not far from me. He was right there in the dark room. I knew where he stood. I felt his warm hand on my friend's shoulder. I hugged him. I begged him. he was with me in the narrow confines of a small room, taking up no space at all. God doing that, to abide in a sense in finitude, demonstrate his love for me. He cannot be there. If man is in the neck, he never strays to him. And he demonstrates not my yesterday, but humility of faith. Not majesty, but humility. In short, cosmic man experiences my yesterday, the majesty of God. Origin conscience. Lowly man experiences humility. And you understand very well that if Judaism operates these two basic God experiences, my yesterday and humility, then Judaism must have two moral systems, two ethical codes, one based revealed to man by the majestic king, and another ethical code revealed to man by the humble father and friend and mother. He does not deserve that. Let's not forget it. Jewish morality is based upon imitatio Dei, upon imitation of God. So it means man has a double job. It's a dialectical assignment given to man. He does to imitate majestic king, or to imitate man. And the dual religious experience has its defect upon Judaic morality. There are two moralities, two ethical gestures. And let us realize these two ethical gestures. The moral or ethical gesture of Catholic men aims in the Tatsya Dei, by a Phoenix in God, Wolach to the Drachot, following his footsteps with his majesty, with his king, with his ruler, so what should man be? Majestic, king, and ruler. The moral gesture of cosmic man aims at majesty or at kingship. The highest moral achievement for cosmic man is sovereignty, kingship. Man wants to be king because God is king of the world. Man imitating God, and this is a genuine Judaic thought. Men imitating God, quest for kingship, not only over a limited area, but over far and distant regions. Does Judaism have room of that? You'll be surprised if I'll say yes. But yes, in contradistinction to some Christian theologians, not all of them, another thing is more typical of the Protestant denomination than of the Catholic denomination. In contradistinction to some Christian theologians, particularly of Karl Barth and then with Brunner School, the Swiss school of theology, in contradistinction to some Christian theologians, who look askance as men's attempt to reach this top, Judaism not only takes a tolerant stand vis-à-vis those bold experiments, but considers them as an ethical attempt. Man is summoned by God to be ruler, to be king, to be victorious. King, you put everything under his feet. Victory is the most important aspect of kingship. And victory is an ethical goal for Catholic man. And Judaism has that vision. And the human effort to achieve victory is a moral one. Man's desire to be king and victor is a general one. And Judaism has always preached, to die is immoral. To live and to defy death is the most sublime moral achievement. That's why Judaism has displayed such, ancient Judaism has displayed so much understanding for scientific medicine and encouraged, but summoned the sick person to seek medical scientific help at a time when the Middle East was replete with so-called, the medicine man. The Christianity hasn't come to terms with medicine until today. The Christian science acts. The problem is God makes you sick. What right do you have to kill for? But Judaism has never been topic. And underlying the morality of victory is a mystical doctrine, which is dates back to antiquity, that creation is still incomplete. God purposely left one aspect of creation unfinished in order to involve men in a creative gesture and give him the opportunity to become both co-creator with God and also king under me. To triumph over evil, like disease, poverty, death, is a great challenge. Cosmic man and town health. It is a challenge to complete creation. In a word, the ethical code of Cosmic man is pursuing one goal, victory. Victory over an incomplete creation or nature which is at best indifferent and at worst malicious and unthinkable. And if you survey all the ethical systems since the Aristotle through the Middle Ages, I'm not speaking about it. Theological ethical system, but I mean the philosophical ethical system. All our committed, be it the Hedonic ethical system, the Eudaimonic ethical system, the perfectionist ethical system, I mean, all our committed, the one goal which cuts with man and stop you. Victory! And Judaism accepts the goal with certain resolution. Judaism knows that another kind of morality, which is diametrically opposed to the kingship victory morality. What kind of a morality do you use? This one. We said before that man needs God not only in infinity, but in the strength of finding, in distress and disaster. Men encounter not only my yesterday, but the humility day as well. God somehow, well, I said before that God dwells either in infinity or in finitude, in the narrow strait of finitude, in the center of the bush, no extension at all, dimension. What happened? God's glory is God compresses his glory into the narrow strait of human finite destiny. And this humility experience expresses itself in another set of attitudes, very judgment, and in different morality. This humility does not pursue kinship. But what would you suggest with that kinship? Sinfulness. What's the difference between the king and the saint? Kingship is attained through distance. Sinfulness through the king. So Rabbi Hermann Cohen, famous Leocadian, said that the goal of Jewish ethics, of Jewish morality, is sinfulness. Means for us. But this only one set of moral norms. The reason is another set of difference. Kingship is attained through distance. Sinfulness through the king. The king plunges ahead. The saint moves downward. The king drives onward. The saint retreats. The king is always a winner. But if he loses the war, he loses his throne. The king is always a winner, a conqueror. The saint is, I wouldn't say always, is very frequently a loser. The king is busy occupying new territories. The saint gives up all positions of advantage. The king knows no boundaries. The saint is aware of many boundaries. In other words, the new set of moral norms, or the set of the new morality, is the morality of defeat, of retreat and withdrawal. And again, this morality is nurtured by a Kabbalistic mystery, very strange. Namely, death of withdrawal or symptom. God created the world, we say. The first verse in the Bible. Rishit bara elokim et hashamayim et ha'aretz. At the very beginning, God created everything else. However, a question arises, how can a finite world prevail beside God who is infinity? If we view the situation from a mathematical viewpoint, infinity only bows up, smothers finiteness. You know very well, an infinite number plus a finite number equal one, infinity. There is no addition to infinity. So how can a finite world be ruled by infinity? So the Kabbalah gave the answer, it is Luyanic, and later was picked up by Chabad. Chabad plays a central role. The act of creation is identical with the withdrawal. God, metaphorically, of course, metaphorically speaking, retreated in order to make room for a finite world to emerge. He created the world by engaging in a movement of recoil, by stepping aside for the sake of his love for man and the world. God forsook infinity, he sacrifices infinity, and steps aside. Due to the principle of imitatio Dei, we are called upon not only to be king and to conquer, but also to be committed to the movement of recoil in any situation. And Judaism maintains, and it's not so strange, that man must not only be the victor. From time to time, triumph should earn into defeat. Judaism holds the view that man was created for both purposes, for victory and defeat. To be a king and to be a saint. He must know how to fight for victory. He also must know how to take defeat. Mother man, and basically the frustration of mother man, complexity is not limited to the United States. It is typical now of mother man of the Western world. Mother man is frustrated now and helpless because he is committed just to one morality, the morality of his race. He is committed to that morality exclusively. He cannot take the heat. He is simply incapable of retreating. Mother man boasts and he tries to prove it that he never lost a war. I've never been impressed by that. There is something wrong with a man or with a people or a nation that has never lost a war. Man must do something. There is no hope of victory. Defeat is built into the very structure of victory. Man is finite, so it is victory. Whatever is finite is infinite, so is man's victory. And I always think, if our former President Johnson had known of his second morality injury, the morality of taking defeat and admitting mistakes and retreating from a position taken, even if one is the president of the United States, he would be still alive. But he knew only of one set of value judgment, of one ethic, the ethic of being king and victorious and being victorious. This is not only an imperfect ethic, it is on a practical point, a wrong ethic. Two questions arise. In what area of human endeavor does Judaism recommend defeat? And I would say self-defeating action. Not defeat by an enemy, defeat by myself. Dignity forbids man to be defeated by somebody else. For dignity requires of man. Thankfulness requires of man to engage in self-defeating action sometimes. It's very therapeutic, very cathartic, very redemptive. Many it's good even from a pragmatic. You can tell people. Of course, you know the answer is. In all areas. Since Judaism has never limited morality to social relations. The ethical norm between I and the Tao according to Judaism, morality regulates not only inter-human relations between the high and the low, but even the intimate relationship between man and himself. However, self-defeat is demanded mainly in those areas in which man is most intact. In those areas in which the individual expects to find the summum bonum, the realization of his most cherished dream or vision. In those areas in which it is absolutely necessary for the individual to win. Since losing the battle in those areas would mean total failure and frustration. In those areas, God requires of men from time to time to withdraw, to retreat, not to be victorious, but to engage in self-defeat. What was the most precious possession Abraham our patriarch had. What was most precious to Abraham? What? Gold? Sugar? His cattle? There was one precious animal. One precious possession. With what was he concerned about? You all know the answer. Isaac. Without Isaac, Abraham's life would have been a sheer mockery. The laughing stock of Kierkegaard there, of the entire Near East. And because the son said so much to Abraham, God instructed him to engage in self-defeating action. To give up, to give away, to retreat, to invite and failure and beauty. Kach et Bilcha et Yechitcha, Kasher Rabeta et Yitzchak, take thy son, that it is thy son, consider it your possession. You own your son. But Yechitcha, thy only son, it means you'll never get another one. I promise you that. Asher Adeta, whom you love, a Hitra, and us. What about the most exalted vision of Moses? What was the final dream of Moses? What did Moses want the most? For what was he praying so fervently? That Hanam Yala Hashem, my petition God, Hashem Yala King, God, my God, everyone over here, let me just go to Germany now and see the promised land. And accept. Because the promised land meant so much to Moses. God told him to retreat, to withdraw, to remain on the eastern bank of the Jordan, not to cross the Jordan. Is there a more sensitive area in the life of young people, men and women, than their love relationship? And you'll be surprised that the principle of self-defeat, self-defeating action, reigns supreme in this area more than in any other area within the system of Jewish halakha. And I want you to know that halakha has never looked upon sex as the greasy, the strange, irritable particular as something morbid, sinful, bad, evil in itself, and as the monastic philosophy is the halakha in general rejected wholesale all doctrine of contemptus or odium mundi, contempt for the world or hate of the world. Nothing to the halakha, nothing in the world is intrinsically bad. Man can make it bad, and man can redeem anything in this world. However, the halakha was conscious, perhaps no man is conscious of that. But halakha was conscious in every that sex, because of its hypnotic and orgiastic properties, ever the most hypnotic drive, young men or women, and can also degenerate and deteriorate into an orgiastic experience. Because of the hypnotic and orgiastic properties, may turn, sex may turn into brutal and ugly performance. And the victim of such performances is usually the woman, the female, not the male. Therefore, Judaism said, sex is in need of redemption. It has got to be purged at its core. And then you say, at its vulgarity, animality. And this
How do you pray?
That's the second time.
How do you, what should I say, raise to higher universe? The ceremonial? The participation of the clergyman. I am a clergyman, I am a rabbi. My brother is not there. How can sex be redeemed, humanized, elevated, endowed with dignity and responsibility? Only through self-defeat, mainly on the part of the men. Only in the light of this principle do you begin to understand many of the halachic strict rules of separation. As for instance, the rule that after the consummation of the marriage, the young couple should separate for a period ranging between 7, between 8, between 8 and 12. Is this going to be particularly the power of the male? For the male is a conqueror. Never mind. Women believe that they're not chasing. But the power of the, what I say, male personality and the female personality. So, and the same is true of many other religions. The second question is self-defeat is revealing. Is self-defeat is effective from a cathartic viewpoint. When is man supposed to make this movement of the course? When is he summoned to defeat himself? To withdraw? The answer is quite simple. At the instant he realizes that victory is assured. Judaism subscribes to the morality of kingship. Victory, it encourages men to march and move onward to conquest and triumph. However, when the last battle is won, when all boundaries are crossed, and all men have to do is to cross the last boundary. When all that is necessary for consummation of victory is the final plunge, the last leap into the promised land, men is told to stop, making a bow face. If man listens and accepts defeat, the great of all, and to move on to victory and conquest, whatever the gateway is returned to. Abraham was told to withdraw and to defeat himself by giving Isaac's name. He listened. And he was told to resume his march onward to victory and conquest. And thy feet shall prepare the gate of his enemy. Moses was less fortunate. Not less fortunate. He listened. He saw the land and he destroyed it. He never entered the promised land. It was just half a mile away from him. And we, of course, reveal perhaps the central prayer to you, that when he engages in self-defeat, when it makes the movement of recoil or every, that should allow it later to resume its march anyway. And if I were to paraphrase Michael, his famous question, then what does the law require of me? I would answer, only to move on to victory boldly, to retreat humbly, once victory is in front, and to resume the march, really, after man has defeated.